introduce myself, Frederick Negri. Just wanted to welcome you.
Thank you very much. I hear you're going to be in South Bottom.
Absolutely. I think we're even sharing the afternoon panel.
We hadn't met before.
So no.
To meet you.
Me too. I wish I could have joined you earlier, but I knew you had lots of interviews lined up already. The minute you landed almost.
But it's good. I mean, nice to be somewhere and be able to be useful.
Sure. No. Ryan, I think the students were really excited that you did come, and it's a nice coincidence that you were in the area.
Yeah, I know. It couldn't have been possible if I was here already.
No. How long are you staying in Canada?
I'm in Toronto for the next two days, and then till Sunday. Then I'm flying out to New York because I have some work that is to go to Toronto.
Okay. Right, so I was thinking, you're talking for about an hour, right?
Well, they said about an hour. What I intend to do is go on for as long as I can and then leave a lot for people to ask questions. Hello.
Hi. I'm with CGG Radio here on campus. Mm-hmm. Would it be okay if we record your presentation?
Oh.
Thank you very much. Will you be speaking here? What do you
want? It's easier for me because I have some reference material.
Thank
you very much. It would be easier for us too. There's more room to put them.
I was thinking maybe a sort of 5-10 minute intro, sort of background. Most of the students are not law students, so I'm not sure exactly how much I should say. Obviously, you'll present a mandate
well,
as well as the investigation.
Well, I try and be as general as possible and not make it so technical.
Yeah, yeah.
In some places I may have to do, but...
Yeah, sure, okay. I'll try to give a bit to the law students as well, if you're interested in trying to explode. I'm sure a lot of my colleagues would be happy to have that much attendance for some of their lectures. We rarely fill this room completely. So.
One was in business and the other two were in social, some other social.
Well, I'm looking forward to Sao Paulo, but it's a bit close to holidays and everything. Organizers, what they do.
Hello? Hello? Can I ask everyone to please sit down? We're just going to start shortly.
We'll be starting the event soon. Everyone, please take a seat. Thank you very much.
Thank you all for coming. Thank you all for coming, and we're really proud to present this event. And I will let my colleague Noor take over with some more introductions, but thank you so much for coming. This is such an important opportunity for us all.
Thanks, Dina. So I just wanted to give a bit of context, thank you, for this event. So I'm just going to speak briefly, say a few words about the organizers, a few words about procedure, and then I'll ask Professor Maigret to introduce our speaker and get the event underway. So the lecture tonight is organized by the Arab Law Students Association. We're a student group here at the faculty. We're a very small group for now, but we're hoping that we're going to grow because you're going to get interested in this event. So we try to organize a number of events each year that have to do with Arab cultural, political, and legal issues. And we try to have at least... Is it working? Can you hear me? Louder? Okay. So as I was saying, we try to organize events every year that have to do with Arab political, cultural, and legal issues. And we try to have at least one event that deals with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So this year we were very lucky, this semester in particular, we were very lucky that Ms. Hina Jilani accepted our invitation. And actually, the more I get to know her, the more I realize how we lucked out that she accepted our invitation. So you're all very lucky here to be here to listen to her. So Professor Frédéric Maigret, who will be introducing her, is a member of the Center for Human Rights, our co-sponsor, and he's the Canada Research Chair on the Law of Human Rights and Legal Pluralism, and he's the director of the McGill Clinic for the Sierra Leone Special Court. So although the Middle East is not particularly the region that he focuses on in his work, he was kind enough to accept our invitation to chair this event this evening, so we're very grateful to him. And finally, just a few quick words about procedure. After Professor Maigret's introduction, Ms. Jilani will be speaking for about an hour, and after that, we'll be opening the floor for a 30-minute question and answer period. And so 30 minutes is not that long, so we ask you to keep your questions short, maximum 2 minutes, to give everyone, or at least as many people as possible, a chance to ask their questions. And also, one important thing is, I know that this is a topic on which many of us have very strong views, so we may be tempted when we have the mic to ask a question, to want to express those views and make statements. So I just want to remind you that this is not the forum for it, it's a question and answer period. So it's really just for us to get informed. So please be considerate of others and stick to questions. And aussi, s'il y a des questions en français, je pense que M. Maigret sera en mesure de les traduire, donc ne vous gênez pas, même si vos questions sont en français, posez-les. And that being said, I'd like to invite Professor Maigret to introduce the event for this evening.
No, thank you very much for the introduction, and Hina, welcome to the faculty. It's our pleasure to have you. And the center agreed to co-sponsor this event, and the center works on issues of human rights in general, but with a particular interest of several of our members in the issue of protection of civilians in times of war, issues of international humanitarian law. And what I thought I would do, if I can take 5 minutes of your time before introducing you properly, is maybe try to contextualize some of the questions that we're going to be dealing with tonight, not in a regional perspective, because I know little about that, but as part of a larger debate on war, how one can limit the impact of war, and what international law's role could be. So I'm going to suggest 10 points which I think are relevant to this discussion, and I'll try to go through the 10 points in under 5 minutes. So the first thing that we know quite well from the study of war in the 20th century is that civilians have tended to be massively, disproportionately the victims of war. In fact, this has only gotten worse over the last 100 years. So the typical statistic is First World War, 90% military casualties, 10% civilian. Second World War, the proportion is reversed, and it seems that things never improve from there, and that civilians are always the victims of war, despite the multiplication of instruments on the protection of civilians during conflicts. And this is obviously a very worrying trend. It suggests that there's problems of enforcement. It also maybe suggests that there's problems with the laws of war themselves. Second thing is, it's often said that the first casualty of war is truth. And it's often very difficult to figure out and understand what exactly happened during an armed conflict, even more so when the media has been excluded, when organizations like the International Committee of the Red Cross won't officially comment on conflict. And of course, it's very difficult to know what happened when the parties to conflict have diametrically opposite views of what went on. So international lawyers, sort of traditional solution is, well, bring someone from outside, bring a third party, bring someone who's neutral, who's impartial. And of course, the problem is internationally, it's often difficult to find people who are not, who are entirely impartial, who are entirely untainted by world events. And the example that comes to mind is Georgia, Russia war, where, as you know, there's a report was handed down by the European Union recently trying to ascertain who started the conflict, and of course, lots of debates on whether the EU is sort of impartial in this matter, whether individually members of the Commission were impartial, and I think that raises some interesting issues for international law. Third, I think there's an issue of the relationship of politics and law. In ascertaining what happened in a particular conflict, and we know that the international community is under-institutionalized. It's only, you know, partly based on the rule of law. There's a strong element of politics, and so quite often major decisions internationally are taken by political bodies. And sometimes these decisions are that we need to send an impartial investigatory body, but there is a problem of that connection between the sort of fundamentally political nature of the bodies mandating the investigation and the body that carries out the investigation. So that issue arose, for example, in the 1990s with the creation of the ad hoc international criminal tribunals, the tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, for example. And there the argument by some of the defendants who were brought before the tribunal was, well, this tribunal was created by the Security Council. Security Council is a fundamentally political body, so anything that comes out of that fundamentally political body can only be biased and is biased against the Serbs or biased against one of the sides in the conflict. And, of course, we know it's more complicated than that, but there is a problem there of how politics can get becomes transformed into law. Fourth, and this is I don't want to become too technical, and I try not to use Latin in these contexts, but as you know, lawyers tend to like Latin. There's a fundamental distinction in international law between what is known since Roman times as the jus ad bellum and the jus in bello. The jus ad bellum is the right to go to war, to the extent that there is such a thing, for example, in self-defense. And the jus in bello is what you can do when involved in a conflict in terms of conduct of hostilities. Now, one thing that all international lawyers seem to agree on, although it regularly sort of gets lost in, you know, the flow of media commentary, etc., is that the fact that you have a good cause, let's say you're acting in self-defense, for example, in no way relieves you of all of your obligations under the international humanitarian law, under the Geneva Conventions, and there's been historically in the 20th century many attempts to challenge that. At one point, national liberation movements in the 70s said, well, our cause is really worthy web of Viet Cong. We're fighting the sort of imperial invader. We should be allowed to get away with more. And the response generally by international maritime lawyers was, no, the rules are the same and they apply to all. Fifth, and this is, I think, quite an important point that we must never lose sight of, is the laws of war, international humanitarian law, are fundamentally a fairly bloody affair. Okay? So there's a huge tolerance in international law, and this is not something that international lawyers are necessarily proud of. There's considerable tolerance for violence. Right? The assumption is that war exists, and though some things are prohibited, some things are clearly allowed. Obviously, killing other combatants is clearly allowed. That's the whole point of war, is combatants kill each other. But international humanitarian law has had a certain tolerance, for example, for collateral damage, and the fact that, which is a euphemism to describe the fact that civilians may get killed in the course of military operations. Okay. It's only a marginal tolerance, but it's a tolerance nonetheless. But the interesting thing is, unfortunately, and this is, you know, the death of all civilians is tragic, but not all deaths are violations of international humanitarian law. What makes them violations of international humanitarian law is either that they're deliberate, intentional, or manifestly disproportionate. Okay, and these are complex questions. Six, maybe a quick point on proportionality. Central point of the laws of war is your use of force has to be proportional. Certainly on a tactical level. So if you want to take a bridge, for example, you want to take a city, you don't use a nuclear weapon. You don't use a weapon that's totally disproportionate in relation to the military advantage that you're trying to obtain. Okay, and that's sometimes difficult to ascertain on a case-by-case basis because there's, you know, a degree of second-guessing of decisions that are made by commanders in the field, etc. But there's also a notion of proportionality which is more strategic. And that's linked to the jus ad bellum and the extent to which, for example, if you're claiming a right to self-defense, which is recognized by the UN Charter, the extent to which you use force only to self-defend yourself and not in excess of that, which might also happen. Seventh, we have a huge issue, especially in the last two decades, of who's a legitimate target. It used to be simple. It used to be, at least the rules are very clear, a combatant is a legitimate target. A non-combatant is never a legitimate target. Now, the issue becomes more complicated when some individuals switch status, civilians by day, combatants by night, etc. The issue is also made complex by a number of targets that are typically presented as dual use, okay, which might be used for military purposes but could also essential to civilians. And the debate arose during NATO's campaign in Kosovo, where NATO bombed electrical plants far from the front line, and, you know, where the question was, well, is this really necessary? Is this really a military target, or isn't it mostly affecting civilians? There's an issue of asymmetry in warfare, which raises important questions for the laws of war. What happens when a party to conflict, which could be a state or could be a non-state actor, doesn't respect the laws of war? Right? The traditional response is the fact that the other party doesn't respect the laws of war doesn't mean that you can do the same. Okay? But it becomes very complicated when you have sort of both sides, in a sense, violating the laws of war. And again, if I can take an example from Bosnia and NATO's raid, there's a famous incident where NATO bombed what it claimed was a tank, but the tank was just next to a hospital, and there were collateral damage, there were civilian casualties, and there's arguments on both sides that you know, one side is more responsible for the other, or both sides are equally responsible, but it's certainly a complex problem. Ninth, the impact of military strategy on the laws of war. There's been a lot said on this, for example, during the First Gulf War. The sort of zero casualty strategy, sort of official military doctrine on the US side, the idea being that if you're not willing to sustain any casualties whatsoever on your side, the chances are that will augment the risks to civilians. And the debate arose again with Kosovo as to you know, how low NATO planes should fly, even at their own risk, to avoid civilian casualties. And 10th, and this is my final point, there's an issue which is very problematic for international law, which is how does one ascribe different levels of responsibility or the same levels of responsibility to states and non-state actors? Traditionally, international law was all about states. So fairly, it's easy enough. States ratify the Geneva Conventions. It's much more complex with non-state actors. They're not considered to be subjects of international law. They can't become parties to treaties. There is a sense increasingly that they're bound by very similar humanitarian obligations, but there's it's an open question to an extent. So without more on this general background, and because I think you didn't come obviously to listen to me, and I'm sure very impatient to listen to what our guest has to say, I'd like to warmly welcome Hina Jilani. Hina is a lawyer and human rights activist from Pakistan who's been involved for a long time in human rights causes. She, along with her sister, co-founded Pakistan's first all-female legal practice in 1980. She is also one of the founders of the Human Rights Commission of Pakistan and the Women's Action Forum. She founded Pakistan's first legal aid center in 1986. Her human rights litigation work in Pakistan has led her to deal with issues of the rights of women, rights of children, minorities, and prisoners. And perhaps most interestingly for our purposes, she's been involved now for a long time in international human rights work, particularly from 2000 to 2008 as the United Nations Special Representative of the Secretary General on Human Rights Defenders. You also, I learned, a member of the Darfur International Fact-Finding Commission, and a member of the eminent jurist panel on terrorism, counterterrorism, and human rights. So I'm sure I'm forgetting many important points, but without more ado, thanks for being with us, and we're delighted to hear what you have to say.
Professor McRae, Noor, and members of the Arab Students Association, ladies and gentlemen, it gives me great pleasure to be able to come to McGill and talk about the Goldstone Report, because I'm a lawyer, but I'm also a human rights defender myself, and I really understand the importance of establishing the authority of international law and being able to give it that recognition where not just states but all concerned parties will understand that gradually we will be able to move towards a situation and an environment at the international level where there will be accountability for violations of the nature that we see today in many conflicts. Professor Maigret has mentioned several of these which have caused concern and for which institutional arrangements have been made in order that the message goes out very clearly to those who contemplate crimes against humanity, war crimes, or any kind of gross violations of international law, which includes human rights and humanitarian law. So I'm very happy to speak about the Goldstone Report today. I was asked to speak for an hour, which is perhaps justified. This is a 575-page report. It's very difficult to present it in anything less than that. But what I would like to do is carry on as much as I can. But I want to leave more time for questions because, as you may imagine, it's difficult for me to remember the details of each and every incident that we have examined. So I plan really to sort of take you through some of the very striking features of the mission that we conducted. And to be able to give you a background, I'm very grateful to Professor McRae for having brought this whole thing into a context of what applies in terms of international law to situations of conflict. And it will make my task very much easier. I don't intend to be very technical. In some places I may have to be able to show that the members of the mission and the authors of this report have been as diligent as we possibly could be to bring the relevant sections of international law where it applied to the facts that we were gathering. Let me begin, first of all, by the whole situation that brought about the creation of that fact-finding mission to Gaza. As you know, there was a military operation in Gaza from the 28th of December to the 28th of December 2008 and 18th of January 2009, which was called Operation Cast Lead by the Israeli military armed forces. In the wake of this operation, there were several very serious allegations that gross and serious violations of international humanitarian law and international human rights law have occurred. These were brought to the attention of the Human Rights Council and the whole debate culminated in a resolution of the International of the Human Rights Council, the United Nations Human Rights Council, that asked the President of the Council to establish a mission to investigate the allegations that have been made. As you know, and many people have already said this in the wake of the report and even before that in several contexts about the Human Rights Council and the other bodies of the United Nations, that there is a lot of politics that is at play. The resolution, as far as the mission is concerned, is only important to the extent of requiring the President to establish the mission. The resolution did not establish our mandate. The President of the Council established the mandate and the terms of reference for the mission. The mandate of the mission was to investigate all violations of international human rights and humanitarian law in the context of the operation that was carried out in Gaza from 27th December 2008 to the 18th of January 2009, whether before, during, or after. This meant, how did we interpret it? For us, it meant that we were looking at violations and fixing the responsibility for those violations and were not either required to or limited to look at the violations of only one actor or one side involved in that conflict. Our major concern and our major focus was on the victims and the protections that international law grants and guarantees for civilian populations. Nevertheless, it is important to understand that the Gaza operation and the events that we were asked to investigate cannot or could not be looked at in isolation. They were a part of the broader context of a broader conflict which has lasted for many, many years now, for almost four decades. And it would not have been possible for us to assess and evaluate actions that have been taken without putting it in the context of the history of that region. However, we were not unaware that we can't really have a limitless temporal scope of that investigation. So we did settle for a time period, and we thought it would be appropriate to go as far back as we thought where there would still be a relevance to the Gaza operation and not go into the whole, you know, the whole question of the conflict itself, that and the question of the rights of the Palestinians, etc., but sort of concentrated on the Gaza operations and its fallout, its consequences, and then also its causes, and therefore go as far back as that required us to do that. Now, what was the framework that we used? The normative framework for the mission was general international law. The charter, the United Nations Charter, international humanitarian law, international human rights law, and international criminal law. The mission based its work on the independent and impartial analysis of compliance by all concerned actors with their obligations under international human rights and humanitarian law in the context of this operation, and on international investigative standards that have been set up by the UN. We must also remember that the UN, this was not the first inquiry that the UN has launched. There have been several in the context of several other conflicts, including other conflicts in the same region. As you were told earlier, I was a part of the International Commission of Inquiry on Darfur. And there were a lot of similarities between this mission and the mission that I carried out in Darfur with other members. Nevertheless, it is important to remember that each mission also has its own specificities and its own requirements. And therefore, it is important that from your own mandate, then you draw out some terms of reference, and you adopt a certain methodology. Now, for us, the adoption of the methodology was very much determined by the level of cooperation we were going to receive from different stakeholders. Let me state that very early after our establishment, we were given a very clear message that the government of Israel will not cooperate with the mission, which meant that that this non-cooperation was really at three levels. Firstly, we were not given access to any of the officials and other people in authority in Israel because, you know, there were several things that might have been useful for us to clarify and get an explanation for. So at one level, that access was not given. Secondly, we were not given access to Israel itself, so that we could speak directly to victims of in southern Israel who were victims of violations by Palestinian armed groups through rocket attacks. We were also, of course, because of that, deprived of the opportunity to visit the sites ourselves and be able to get a better sense of the psychological impact of those events, the kind of fear that the population in southern Israel lived, the kind of injury and harm and damage that was suffered by the population there. And it makes a difference. Although we had sufficient information without that access also to make our own conclusions, but it makes a difference, and it really does bring more kind of a vitality to the conclusions and the findings if you have been able to see the site and make those investigations by speaking to witnesses and victims in the areas and in the surroundings where violations have occurred. At the third level, Israel's non-cooperation deprived us of the opportunity of being in the West Bank itself and to see for ourselves and investigate more fully the impact of the war in Gaza on the rest of the Palestinian occupied territory. And the actions of the and the practices of the occupation that were a direct result of the operations in Gaza and violations of people's reaction to that operation in the West Bank. And I think that also, in some ways, would have helped us to bring out more visibly and perhaps more with more vigor the impact of the kind of hostilities that were being carried out in Gaza and the kind of impact it was happening in the very the impact of what was happening there in the West Bank as well, and therefore link different forms of violations that stem from the act of force, the use of force, and therefore measure the proportionality of it. Now, in order to make up for some of the problems that the mission felt were going to be confronted by us in being able to do our work, we had to adopt a slightly different methodology from the one that is generally used by UN missions. And we decided to hold public hearings. The purpose of the public hearings was, firstly, to ensure that the voices of the victims are heard directly and not just necessarily reflected in a report that we present to the world and the international community. These public hearings were carried out by were carried by and broadcast by the media the world over. They were put on the United Nations sites, and people were able to hear it. We held one public hearing in Gaza and the other one in Geneva. The reason why we held one in Geneva was because that was the only venue where we could arrange for victims from southern Israel to come. And these were not just victims, but also people, NGOs, people who had information about the operation in Gaza, who were not able to communicate with us directly because of our inability to go to Israel. And so there was a substantial body of material that we were able to collect. Now let me just say one thing and make it very clear. This was neither a judicial nor a quasi-judicial inquiry. Therefore, the standard of proof was not that of a criminal investigation, which is that of certainty without any reasonable doubt. That was certainly not the threshold. This was an investigation which made its conclusions and its findings based on a body of material which was, in our estimation, credible and reliable. And why did we decide that the information was reliable or not? How did we make that assessment? This assessment was based on the UN standard of such inquiries, which is that you interview witnesses, you interview victims, and you interview people, a substantial number of people from different backgrounds, experts, professionals, people who have different affiliations, and find it and make your findings based on facts which are consistently received from different sources, facts which are also consistent with our own observations on the ground, site inspections, etc. And I have some figures I want to give you, if I find them, regarding the number of people that we met and the people that we consulted with. I don't think I'm going to be able to find it in these notes. Anyway, what is important to say is that during the period that we were concerned with, several hundred incidents had happened and had been reported. We had only 3 months to make our investigations. It was therefore important for us to be selective in the incidents that we chose to do more detailed investigations into. It is always a difficult choice for any mission, so that we don't become one-sided in the selection, and that can really be a very tricky task. We investigated 36 incidents. Our choice was really based on, firstly, to choose those that illustrated a certain pattern. And secondly, incidents which we knew that we had the capacity and the time to gather sufficient information about to be able to give conclusive findings on it. And you will see that all these incidents relate to different forms of violations. And the report very clear, kind of separated all these, and as you can see from the report, there were incidents that involved destruction of property, there were incidents that involved deliberate attacks on civilians, the right to life was being had been violated in those attacks, and incidents that in some ways reflected the compliance with international law, like the obligation to take feasible precautions to protect civilians, and incidents were chosen to show whether those feasible precautions had been taken and that standard had been kept up. Then there were attacks on the way of life. How do you affect not just civilian lives and civilian property, but also the foundations of civilian life in Gaza, how that was affected. So incidents that showed, a destruction of grain factories, destruction of chicken farms, which are all a part of international law and the kind of protections that are given by international law. So this is how we sort of selected these incidents and came to our findings on the basis of site visits and interviews that we were able to do with different people involved in those incidents. The other thing that became important was also to set this whole mission, the work of this mission, in the context of what is the status of the legal status of the territory in which the conflict has occurred, and what is the status of the people who have been affected by that conflict. And in that context, I will very briefly say that we found, on the basis of international law and the circumstances that surround the Gaza territory now, that Gaza remains an occupied territory. Many of you perhaps know that Israel withdrew its presence, physical presence, on Gaza in 2005, and thereafter declared that, you know, nobody can now say that Gaza is under occupation. However, international law is very clear on when do you qualify a certain situation as an occupation of a territory. And all those criteria still apply to Gaza, and I'll tell you why. It is not necessary under international law that the occupying power must have a physical presence in the occupied territory. The occupying power, in many cases, historically, gives up a certain part of administration and is not physically present in the occupying territory, in the occupied territory, although that may be one of the elements that qualifies that territory as an occupied territory, but it is not one of the necessary elements or the only element that is important for this qualification. There must be effective control still in the hands of the occupier. Effective control in the case of Gaza is established by the following. Given the specific geopolitical configuration of the Gaza Strip, Israel exercises from the borders control over all conditions of life within the Gaza Strip. Israel controls the border crossing. It decides what and who gets in and out of the Gaza Strip. Controls the territorial sea adjacent to the Gaza Strip, has declared a virtual blockade and limits to that the fishing zone, thereby regulating economic activity in that zone, keeps complete control of the airspace of the Gaza Strip, including through continuous surveillance by aircraft and unmanned, the unmanned aviation vehicles or drones. It makes military incursions and from time to time hits targets within the Gaza Strip. Israel has declared areas within the Gaza Strip as no-go areas near the border, and it administers them and makes sure that they are no-go areas. It enforces those no-go areas. It regulates the local monetary market based on the Israeli currency, controls taxes and custom duties. What the Gazans eat for dinner is really dependent on what the current policy of the Israeli government is with regard to what they let in into Gaza. So that level or degree of control very clearly qualifies Gaza as an occupied territory. This has been reinforced, this view has been reinforced by the Security Council, and it has stressed that the Gaza Strip constitutes an integral part of the territory occupied in 1967 and will be a part of a Palestinian state. So the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, in the decision on the legality of the wall, has also said that the West Bank and Gaza constitute a unit, and one unit, and it still continues to be. So there is no way that we can accept
occupation of the West Bank and say that Gaza is not an occupied territory. And I'm just going into this so that you understand the context in which, because international law will have to be applied, keeping all this in mind. What is the responsibility of the occupying power towards the occupied people? So apart from the other responsibilities under international law, Israel also has a responsibility towards the occupying power. Now, having said that, I want to now also say a little bit about Israel's point of view and position on this. Israel has moved the United Nations several times, and Israeli position on this has been reiterated again and again, that Gaza is a hostile territory, or they declared Gaza as a hostile territory, because of the rocket attacks that have consistently been launched by Palestinian armed groups, including the Hamas, from Gaza, from the territory of Gaza, which has caused damage to property. It has also caused harm, physical harm, to civilians, including death and injury. That's the position of Israel. And they have, in several public statements, said that the Gaza operation in December, January 2008-2009 was really an insult. When I was in Israel in 2005 as a part of my mandate as a mission, on a mission as a part of my mandate as the SRSG on human rights defenders. And one of the issues that came up before them was the practices of the occupation. And many Israeli lawyers, politicians, officials, said to me that occupation in itself is not illegal. That's true. On the other hand, when I raised the question of violations of the rights of civilians and international law and the protections under international law with armed groups on the Palestinian side, including the Hamas, they said to me, international law recognizes the legitimacy of resistance to occupation. They were also true. That was also true. However, the answer to both of them is how the occupying power conducts itself with relation to the occupied population is regulated by law. Occupation may not have been declared illegal by international law, but practices of the occupation can certainly be legal or illegal, because international law has laid down the responsibility under international law of the occupying power. In the same way, nobody disputes the right of anyone to self-determination, nor the legitimacy of resistance. International humanitarian law talks about resistance. They talk about the protections and the status of people who are resisting and who are part of a resisting force. So nobody disputes that. Nevertheless, those who are resisting occupation or denial of the right to self-determination have to do it within the civilized norms. They have to respect the protections guaranteed by international law to civilians. And I think this is the only extent to which we draw an equivalence in the situation that we are looking at between the different parties. Otherwise,
there is, I think, and this was, I think, a considered and a agreed position of all members of this fact-finding mission, that there is no equivalent as such. We don't have to make comparisons or balance anything. Of course, we have to give an even-handed view of the situation that we are asked to investigate. Because there is no equivalent. There is a state party on the one hand, whose responsibilities are very clearly laid down under international law. They are members of the United Nations, and therefore a system of accountability has been set up. On the other hand, there are non-state actors, who in my view should certainly not have any misguided view that they are safe from scrutiny or from accountability. Nevertheless, as Professor Negre has already said, there are certain complexities involved in it. But at the same time, in the situation of Gaza, we have to understand that while all civilians are important and all civilians have a right to security, all civilians have a guarantee of protection under international law, there is a difference in the capacity to harm and do damage, and the capacity to protect, and therefore the responsibility to protect, how far that responsibility can be fulfilled between the so-called parties. So it is in this context that we look at the whole situation of Gaza. I'm sorry to say or take you through such a detailed kind of explanation, but it is important to understand where the mission drew its guidance from, because it was very important for the final assessment of the situation that we were asked to do. Now I will come very quickly to some of the more factual things. When we entered Gaza, this was my first trip to Gaza. I have been to Israel and the OPT, the Occupied Palestinian Territories, on a UN mission in 2005, but wasn't able to go to Gaza because of certain situations that were there, and Gaza was out of bounds for us. This was my first visit, and the first thing that I saw as we drove through Rafah to Gaza City, the extent of destruction. So that was, having seen that, having a visual idea of the kind of the scale of destruction, it was very obvious that we were going to look at this whole question of why and how this destruction had occurred. And answering these two questions would lead us to whether there has been a compliance, a non-compliance with international law or not. Destruction can happen anywhere as a part of war. And the degree of destruction doesn't imply that there has been non-compliance with international law. You have to then see whether there was a military objective and a military necessity behind that destruction, and whether that destruction, the scale of its destruction, was proportionate to the military necessity that was to be achieved. On this, and I think everybody has access to the report, so I wouldn't want to go into details, but on our on further investigation, we came to the conclusion that the buildings that had been targeted were a part of the civilian infrastructure and were not per se military, could not per se be military objectives or military targets, sorry. Could not be. The second step was to see, all right, are these collateral damage? What is there around these buildings? We had absolutely no evidence that there was any military objective to be achieved by the destruction of almost every building that had been destroyed there. So it was our finding that there has been wanton destruction of civilian infrastructure without any visible military objective. Then we went to some of the explanations that Israel was not talking to us. They didn't want to give us any explanations. They didn't want us to give us any of their point of view. Although at the end of the investigations in Gaza, we had sent the Palestinian Authority, the Gaza de jure authorities, de facto authorities, and the Israeli government a set of questions, again giving a chance for all three parties to know our line of thinking at that time, what were our concerns, and to be able to address those concerns. The Palestinian Authority and the Gaza authorities did give a response to those questions. Israel still didn't. But let me also stress over here that nobody should have any misconception that any finding or any conclusion was made only because of a lack of response from Israel. We went to material that was available publicly. Statements by Israeli officials, one or two reports that Israel has also set, put out after the Gaza operations. And after having seen them and having found in those reports some consistency with regard to our findings on policy and intention, were the conclusions and the findings made. We found something positive. We just didn't say, okay, we don't have an explanation, so we presume against Israel. That did not happen. It was same with the Hamas. Every observation that we make against the armed groups and every conclusion that we make against them is based not only on the facts that we gathered on the ground, but further inquiries that convinced us with regard to the intention of the mens rea. So this was because this is not the first time that Justice Goldstone or I or the other two members of the mission have done these kind of investigations. We know that these are important missions. They are very sensitive issues that we are investigating, and that they can have a very sensitive impact on the actors involved. It's not lightly taken when you accuse a government of violating international law. It should not be lightly taken. And therefore, every mission has that burden to discharge, to make sure that everything that we say, what we don't say is another thing altogether, where, you know, we haven't said anything. We haven't said it because we couldn't make conclusive findings on it. But what we have said is based on facts
that we have thoroughly examined, are satisfied that they were credible and reliable, and have based our finding on that. And then, on the facts, we applied the law. Now here, as all lawyers would understand, I wouldn't mind if somebody had a different view of the law from me, or interpreted it in a different way. There can always be an argument on that. I'm very convinced, as I am when I'm pleading a case in the court, I'm very convinced about the way that I look at the law. But what we have also said is, these are findings which can be built upon by the international community and international bodies like the United Nations. These are not findings that are based on evidence that satisfied the standard of proof of a criminal investigation, but are only indications of violations that have occurred, which must be further investigated to collect sufficient proof for prosecution. And I think to that extent the Goldstone report has done remarkably well given the constraints and the limits that we have. Then there was this whole question, once we had looked at the physical situation or the physical sites of Gaza, obviously if there was that kind of destruction of property, there was also loss of life. And I would like to take you through one or two incidents. I won't take you through too many, because I think the report is there and you should read it. There was deliberate targeting of civilians on both sides. In the case of the armed groups, targeting of civilian population in southern Israel had been going on since 2001. There may not have been as many victims as on the Palestinian side, but for me that's not important. Even one civilian casualty is too much if it's being done deliberately and recklessly. The answer to some of the people that we interviewed from Hamas, because the other armed groups including me, Hamas said, we are a political organization. The armed groups, including the Al-Qassam Brigade, which is the armed side of the Hamas, the armed portion of the Hamas, the armed groups that are allied with Hamas. They said, we are not responsible for that, and we don't know what their tactics are. Nevertheless, I first of all, I don't believe that that's true. But even if it is true, they are a de facto authority in Gaza, and therefore have a responsibility, almost the same as any government would have, to ensure that actions of the kind that we have found are not committed from the territory under their control, either to harm their own civilians or to harm civilians anywhere else in the adjacent areas. And we have very clearly stated that in the report. One of the answers I got, which was rather funny, was, well, if you want us to spare civilians, give us more sophisticated weapons. Because this happens only because we don't have weapons that are so precise. And of course, therefore, we can't protect civilians. We are, of course, targeting military objectives, but of course, we can't do it precisely. If armed groups maybe didn't start with the intention of harming civilians, but have consistently harmed civilians, they have the knowledge that whether it's because their weapons are flawed and they can't hit precise targets, they are still harming civilians, and they consistently go on using those weapons and launching rocket attacks. In our opinion, that amounted to deliberate attacks against civilians. On the other hand, now look at the whole situation that we are confronting in Gaza. And I wish I had been more organized in making my notes, because I had some very interesting statistics for you, which if I start looking for it, I'll probably waste a lot of time. Right. In terms of what is involved as human lives and human suffering, let me give you some figures. 1987 to 2000, Israel-Palestinian conflict claimed the lives of 1,549 Palestinians and 421 Israelis. September 2000 to December 2008, look at the escalation of figures. 5,500 Palestinians were killed, 593 of these as a result of intra-Palestinian violence. 162 Israelis and 64 foreigners were killed. Now, 1993 to 2007, 154 suicide bomb attacks took place, killing 542 individuals. The peak was in 2002, with 220 killed in 55 suicide attacks. The last recorded suicide attack took place in February 2008. The firing of rockets and mortars from Gaza into Israel began in 2001. Israeli sources report that as many as 3,455 rockets, 3,742 mortar shells were fired into Israel from Gaza until mid-June 2008. So you can imagine that with that kind of violence that occurs, there are victims on both sides. Nevertheless, as I said earlier, there is a state which is bound by international law to conduct its activities in an occupied territory as an occupying power on the one hand, on the other, as a party to a conflict, it has certain responsibilities. It has to comply with certain very fundamental principles in conducting hostilities. And consistently violates those regulations, not only with respect to the recent conflict in Gaza, but consistently with respect to all incursions that it has undertaken into Gaza and the West Bank. When the hostilities started in December, 28th of December 2008, in the first till the 3rd of January, 4th of January, there were air attacks. On the 4th of January, the land invasion took place. Till the 4th of January, Israeli attacks caused extensive damage to buildings and infrastructure. Most of the fatalities that occurred were a part of the first incident on the 28th of December, when the civilian police was targeted. And 200 and something were killed on the first day.
This was the first strike. Then some civilian deaths occurred as a part of bombardment. But most of the deaths amongst civilians have occurred after the ground invasion on the 4th of January. One incident that I would like to take you through is the incident that involved civilians who civilians in areas where the Israeli military took under its control and under its control. And I live in Pakistan, you know, and I'm a human rights activist, and I see distressing incidents every day of my life. I have been to Darfur. I've seen sufferings. I've seen sufferings in many parts of the world. But I have been extremely distressed by those incidents which we investigated, where civilians were deliberately targeted by the Israeli soldiers, not only killed, but also their dignity violated to an extent which is beyond human tolerance. It is absolutely unacceptable. Absolutely unacceptable. Whatever your standards of looking at actions of militaries and soldiers and your assessment and evaluation of what happens in a war. I've been to Afghanistan. In the wake of what the Taliban did there, and now, after there is such a degree of conflict there. And I can tell you, there is nothing worse than the cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment that a foreign army can mete out to a civilian. To some of those people who spoke to us, loss of life was not as bad as what they felt they suffered because of the treatment. I spoke to mothers who were relating to me, and this is not one mother, several such incidents happened, and I was rather surprised that this has happened to that extent, who are fleeing attacks, have a small baby in their arm, and suddenly they realize that the baby has been hit and is dead. I think there were four such incidents where women related this to me. And I think I felt that this mother really had amazing resilience if she's able to relate it back to me. And they were not shedding tears. Sometimes I thought that they have this feeling as if they are telling the story of a third person. And I do believe very strongly that yes, we are objective. We are absolutely objective in our assessments, and we must be objective to some extent. But as human rights people, too much of your objectivity, which allows you to become immune to outrage, takes a lot out of your sense of justice. If you are not outraged, you will not cry for justice.
And I do believe in being outraged to some extent, to an extent where it does not impair my judgment. And that's why I say this to you in this tone. There was this community where there is no evidence of either a resistance or any presence of the resistance. The Israeli military had already invaded. The land invasion had taken place. They had been in control of that particular area for almost 24 hours. When they enter a house forcefully, they call upon the people to get out of the house with their hands, in the air. And when this man is just standing there on the call of the army, standing outside with his hands up, one of the soldiers shoots him. We have looked through all material that the Israeli government has produced. There is not a single mention of this incident. And in the same locality, there is another incident. The Israeli army enters a house. They call on the residents to come out. All the people inside that house start going out, and the head of the house starts telling them, this is so-and-so, this is so-and-so. They all give their names. While they're coming out and they're reciting their names and introducing themselves to the soldiers who are holding them at gunpoint, some soldiers break into the house and start shooting. Young children get hurt. They're all lying on the floor while they're shooting, but they do get hurt. One of them later died. Then they ask this whole family to move to another house in that area, which is owned by relatives. And some of the other neighbors are also herded into that house. There are about 100 people sent by the army itself to those homes. And then that house is shelled. 29 people of the same family died. Those who escaped death, some were injured, others were not injured, tried to escape from that area. They are told to go back by the Israeli soldiers outside in the street. Somehow, after a few hours, they are let out and some of them leave, but they left their injured behind because they couldn't carry as many as they, they couldn't carry anybody. The ICRC and the PCRC, the Palestinian Red Cross ambulances are turned away. They are not allowed to come. They were allowed to come 3 days later. This incident happens on the 4th of January, 5th of January. Ambulances come, are turned away. They were not allowed to come till about the 7th or 8th of January. By that time, some of the injured died. Others who have survived are in a terrible state. When they are even allowed in, there is some kind of an obstruction that they have the Israeli soldiers had put up in the street. So the ambulances can't go right up to the house. They had to park several hundred feet away. And they had to carry the injured out. No assistance is provided. And this is one of the most regrettable violations. Not only are civilians deliberately targeted, the obligations that and responsibility towards civilians that the soldiers should have had are never fulfilled. The injured and other civilians are treated with extreme lack of consideration, but also in an extremely humiliating manner. People, apart from this incident, there are other incidents where people are trying to evacuate the injured, and soldiers know that these are people who are trying to evacuate the injured. There are children, there are women, they are shot at, and people are killed during the evacuation process. In the process of evacuation, people have been killed because of Israeli shooting. They have not allowed the family to take the body, and the body was left there for days before they could be taken away by ambulances and the other staff and get other assistance. There was one incident which particularly distressed me a lot, which was the shooting of three young little girls. Now here, this is an environment in which there is no military target anywhere near. There is no presence of the resistance. The army has been there for sufficient number of period of time to be able to establish that there is no open resistance anywhere. They call for a man to come out of his house. They come out. They are looking towards the soldiers to give them the instructions on what to do. He comes out. He has his three little girls and his old mother. The two soldiers are having a snack, sitting on a tank. A third soldier suddenly comes out of the same tank and shoots at the three little girls. Two of them die on the spot. The third was so severely injured that today she is a paraplegic and she is disabled for life. There is absolutely no explanation for these incidents. It's the same for other kinds of destruction, and I'll stop here and I hope you can ask questions because I must have left a lot out. Where the only flour mill in Gaza, because of the blockade, you understand there's been a blockade, and I'm sorry, I should have addressed the blockade as well. There has been a blockade of Gaza since 2007. Just as soon as Hamas took control of Gaza, de facto control of Gaza. Nothing gets in and nothing gets out. The movement of people is severely restricted, and I believe those. I used to think that this is just a kind of a metaphor that people use when they say Gaza is a big prison. But once you've been there, you understand that it's literal. People can't get in and people can't get out. So when there was this war, and Israel claims that they did give due warning to civilians when they were going to attack a certain place, the question in everybody's mind is, where do they go? There was no place to go. There were also several incidents which we have given in the report to establish that these warnings were actually ineffective warnings, because the civilians' experience was that if you are given a leaflet that says that your locality is going to be bombed and please leave, when they are leaving, they are bombed. Or they are killed by soldiers on the street. So even in the act of obeying those warnings and complying with those warnings, killings have happened. So how much faith will a civilian have in this kind of warning? So is this under the law an effective warning? If the experience of the civilians is that there is not just a subjective but an objective assessment on their part that if we leave, we are going to be killed. Several such incidents are cited in the report to show, number one, that as far as the blockade is concerned, the reasons behind that blockade, the consequences of the blockade, and the manner in which that control is imposed is clearly collective punishment of the people of Gaza. If the Israelis have a problem with Hamas, and I'm sure that there is a problem, in that region there is a problem with everybody. How are the people of Gaza deserving of the kind of injury and the damage that is being imposed on them? The blockage is very well described in the report, and the details of it would satisfy even the most exacting critic that this, and there are several statements that we have quoted from Israeli officials, Israeli official publications, that this that makes very clear that this is a part of a collective punishment. They have said as much in some of their statements. Not saying that we are imposing collective punishment on you because you've elected the Hamas, but saying that we have to resort to this because of the difficulties that the Hamas has created. The very fact that the destruction of civilian infrastructure is justified by the Israelis on the logic that every government building is a part of the terrorist infrastructure, because it is obviously the de facto authority there and government there is the Hamas. So the Palestinian Legislative Council, the Ministry of Education, the prison, the only prison that there is in Gaza, they are bombarded. So, I mean, it is not likely that the mission concludes that the action that took place were a part of a policy. This policy is not presumed on our part. This policy is the fact that there is a policy is concluded from statements of the Israeli government from time to time in different contexts, and also in the context of Gaza, that clearly show that this is the case. Now, there is, as I said, criticism of the report. It was not unexpected. I'm sure that when we wrote the report on Darfur and recommended that the Security Council refers the case to the International Criminal Court, several people in Darfur didn't like it either. The question is, all criticism is welcome where there is an engagement with regard to the substance of it. Claim that there is either partiality involved or there is a one-sided mandate are really not very important and don't really go to the credit of those who criticize. They should come out with it. I'm sure that somebody can bring something out on substance that we can engage with them on. It is difficult to engage on something which is so superficial and so hollow that there is really no, there is really no benefit for anyone to engage in a kind of an argument on it. As far as we are concerned, as authors of this report, we have fulfilled our responsibility, and as I said several times before, we had a responsibility to find the facts and apply the law. We have done it. We have given it to the Human Rights Council. Now the current situation is that the Human Rights Council, after initial pondering on it, has sent it to the General Assembly. The General Assembly has adopted the report and have requested the Secretary General to present it to the Security Council, and the Secretary General has sent it to the Security Council. What happens to it in the Security Council, we don't know. But our recommendation has been, firstly, that Israel should conduct investigations internally into these very serious incidents that we have given our conclusions and our findings on, and to prosecute serious violations of international human rights and humanitarian law. Hamas should do the same. And if either of these two fail to do so, or if any of their investigations don't seem credible, then the Security Council should send the case to the International Criminal Court, as in the case of Darfur. The only reason why there is a difference in the two cases is there because we feel that at least Israel does have the institutions and the capacity to investigate. The question is, will it investigate? Is there a will to investigate impartially? But the institutions are there. So that chance must be given for internal investigations which can satisfy the international community. And I must say, to the credit of Israeli civil society, I think they have made it amply clear that not only does Israel owe this to the Palestinian population who has become victim of these hostilities, but also to the international community, but more than anything else, to its own people. I'm sure that no Israeli would like to live under that shadow of being the citizen of a state against whom there are such serious violations of international law, some of which, and I'm not saying all, some of which amount to atrocities. So I hope that this particular report will be a step towards peace and not an impediment to peace. There is never any peace without justice. Justice is never an impediment to peace and never should be considered that. Those who are interested in a peace process must understand that the conflict is based on the violations of human rights. This is a part of the conflict. Without addressing these violations, no sustainable peace is possible. We also hope that the Goldstone Report will open the way towards development of international law. More and more conflicts today in the world are involving non-state parties. We would like non-state parties to feel that they are accountable for violations, so that human suffering, in the interest of protecting human beings, it's not this side or that side, but in the interest of protecting human beings, we would want the actions of non-state parties also to be tested. And if there are reasons to hold them accountable, there must be an appropriate forum and an appropriate process. And I think there is already that responsibility is there. Enforceability presents some complexity. And in that direction, I hope the international law is further developed. If by changing the laws of war means that you change the principles and you withdraw the fundamental guarantees of civilized behavior and of protection of innocent civilians, then I'm afraid that change will not be a positive change. It will be a deterioration rather than and a regression and not a progress in international law. Thank you. Thank you.
we're going to open it up to questions. So anyone who has a question, you can just stand in either of the rows. And, yeah, we'll come up to you.
We also ask that the questions be brief and concise, and we're capping them at 2 minutes, please. Come right ahead.
I need a mic. Okay. Hi, thank you very much for coming. I was just wondering, considering the limitations you outlined, how this was a non-judicial process, how you had a very low threshold for evidence, and how you were very selective on the incidents, and how you did not have an Israeli perspective, and I would add a couple limitations on my own, that you were dealing with people who are living in an authoritarian state where Fatah activists get their kneecaps blown off. Just for being against the regime.
Sorry, can you repeat that? Yes.
I'm just outlining the limitations. Sorry, the last part was considering, I said I would add a couple more limitations, which would be, for example, that you were doing this investigation in what is basically an authoritarian state in Gaza, where opposition members like Fatah officials get their kneecaps blown off. Considering those limitations, why should the international community take anything in the Goldstone Report seriously, including some of the atrocities that you outlined, which, if they did happen, of course, are horrible. But what if they didn't happen?
Go ahead.
No, that's fine. You can have a seat. Thank you for the question.
All right.
We can take two at a time.
All right.
Yep.
I just want to thank you again for coming today. I had a question. When we received the Goldstone Report, there was a strong condemnation by the Israeli government, which was clearly expected, but there was also a muted response, at least from what we got out of the media, from governments like the United States, even European governments. There was a clear sense that no one was willing to speak out. I just want to get a sense from you, working within the United Nations, what the actual response has been, even though the report hasn't necessarily gone through the Security Council yet. Thank you so much.
Hi, so again, thank you for coming and speaking. I just want to go back to what you were talking about when you said you investigated some of these areas that Israel bomb shelled. Under allegations that there were weapons there, and you said you investigated and found nothing.
Sorry?
You said you investigated these areas and found nothing. However, you're basing my opinion at least, is that you're basing those claims on both Hamas telling you that there was nothing there and you going there and seeing nothing, but at the same time, that doesn't necessarily mean that there weren't weapons there to begin with. What was Hamas supposed to do? Just leave their weapons there for the sake of the report's integrity. So on one hand, you discard photographs that Israel sent to you of weapon piles. You discard what Israel said, but at the same time, you accept editorializations that Hamas officials gave you about this and that massacre of civilians. So my question to you is, how can you discard evidence Israel sent you while at the same time accept editorializations or claims that made by Hamas officials and civilians that really had no more proof than the Israelis might have?
I guess we'll take one more and then maybe you can answer.
Okay.
My question is, and I'm not sure if you can answer this, but what is at stake if people don't take this report seriously?
Okay.
Thank you.
First of all, I will take your question where you said, I've not said that the threshold was low. You said that we have made our findings on the basis of what I thought, what you said I had said was a low threshold. It was not a low threshold. I did say low threat. It wasn't a standard of proof beyond any reasonable doubt. And I suppose you can tell the difference. We only made conclusions
when we had credible and reliable and sufficient information to make that conclusion on the basis of a body of material that we had collected. This is not a low standard. It's only a different standard from the one that you use for prosecution of criminal offenses. And we have, and I think everybody knows, that whenever there is a fact-finding mission of the United Nations, which is short of a judicial commission, there are judicial commissions as well, that they are not supposed to prove anything beyond any shadow of doubt. Our reports and our findings in similar situations are then used by the concerned parties and relevant actors to build upon so that they produce evidence of the level which is necessary for starting a prosecution. This happened in Darfur, this happened in Serbia, this happened in Gaza, this happens everywhere. So don't confuse a different standard of a different threshold of evidence of assessment and evaluation to come to a conclusion. Secondly, you say there is an authoritarian state. What do you expect from there? And what if these things didn't happen? We were not dependent on the Hamas and were not guided by the Hamas either to investigate incidents or in the facts that we received were not from Hamas and not from the authorities there. They were from victims, from witnesses, from people who had different associations. Our source of information was not limited to one person or a few people. We had a number of testimonies. We had our own observations at the site. We had then analyzed the information we had and then evaluated it in accordance with the standard of consistency that we had set for ourselves. There was consistency in those facts that were related by different people. There was no margin of error in that respect, to the extent that you're saying, what if it did not happen? I wish it hadn't happened. If I see the kind of harm that was done to those three little girls, I wish it hadn't happened. I wish it was not the truth. Secondly, there was a question on condemnation of Israel by Israel of the report, and that was not all, but that the U.S. and the... Yes, I think there was different levels of criticism. The U.S. did criticize it more strongly, for instance. The Europeans have not criticized it. In fact, Sweden, as the president of the European Union in the Human Rights Council, when we were presenting the report, did not say anything in condemnation of the report. In fact, they said it's a very serious report and must be taken very seriously by the Human Rights Council. These are exact words of the Swedish presidency in their comment as a representative of the EU. The U.S., unfortunately, had stronger words. The U.S. representative, apart from what the Congress has said, at that time said that this was a flawed report, but at the same time urged the Israeli government to hold investigations. If they totally disbelieved the report, they would not have urged the Israeli government to hold investigations. So there are very mixed feelings. And as I said, there has been no detailed response to this report or rebuttal of its findings by anyone so far. All that we hear are, of course, that this was biased, that the mandate was biased, and we've tried to respond to it because we understand that there is, as I said, I don't take accusing governments lightly, and I don't think that the effect of that is or the consequences of that are very insignificant. So it's very important that there should be clarifications if there are any that are required. Now you say that we investigated places and didn't find weapons in it, and Hamas tells us that there was this happening. Let me assure you that Hamas doesn't tell us anything. And I'll just give you one incident. There was a mosque that was hit. And you talked about Israel giving us photographs of weapons and stockpiles of weapons. Believe me, Israel has given us nothing. I wish they had cooperated to that extent. Sorry? Yes. First of all, the only photographs that we received of any stockpiling in mosques, for instance, was not in this period. It was a 2007 photograph that was there. And nobody has so far given us anything of recent origin. Secondly, yes, that's true. And you can please go back to the report and check up your facts. Those facts are very well stated here, and all the references are given in the footnotes. I remember this reference to these photographs also. These were of previous incidents, and the Israelis have never said to us that this was a recent incident, where or the mosques that were actually bombed, that was the one that was bombed was called Al-Muqaddama Mosque. It was bombed when there were 250 people inside that mosque who were praying. These were people from that community where that mosque is located. There were women, there were children, and there were men. I refuse to believe that if Hamas is using that mosque as a weapons depot, the local population would, at a time when they know that there are drones above and that the drones have the technology to detect very, very easily what is going on, they would either go to pray there or take their children. I could have presumed that, all right, they weren't praying. This was a gathering of the resistance and their supporters inside a mosque. But we investigated, and we found that there were children and there were women, because the injured were children. Children with their legs were blown off. The victims were, amongst the victims were women and children. So.
Excuse me, your question is over.
No, you, okay. There were, on Human Shields, we have a very clear finding. As far as the incidents that we have investigated, we have not found even a single case. There may be. We have also indicated in some places that we have seen the presence. We have felt or we've come to the conclusion that there is presence of resistance. But there has not been a single incident in which the hundreds of people that we have interviewed, not a single one of them said to us that we stayed in a certain place that was under attack by Israel because the Hamas was keeping us there. Not a single witness has said it to us. I'm not saying it didn't happen anywhere, but the incidents that we have investigated, absolutely not a single one. So you see, it's very difficult for me, having been there, looked at the facts, to give much credence to these stories. There are other things which we found more credible to understand. There were places where we felt that the resistance was there. There was certain areas in which we felt that the destruction could be, because there was the presence of resistance fighters. There were several incidents in which people denied it, but we came to the conclusion on the basis of evidence that we had that yes, there was resistance presence there. So it's not only one-sided. There were also incidents where people denied that there was any, but there was also evidence, and there were witnesses who said that there are. You are talking about an authoritarian state. You see the body of material that we have against Hamas. Where did you think that information came from? People were there who were talking about it. So if there is any